faith, it's my voice. You've made change both my hands, but never my soul. No, never my soul, it's my voice.
This is Iran Radio, and we have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning the recitation, the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as chapter Al-Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. This chapter, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions too. Now we listen to the translation of this holy chapter. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. And now the continuation of the programs. You are listening to Iran Radio. Coming up in this hour, we begin with the spotlight. Afterwards, we return with another segment of radio production. Up next, spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
The spotlight.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
The plight of Palestinian inmates in Israeli prisons has become a defining human rights crisis, exposing what many advocacy groups and international observers describe as systematic crimes against detainees. Reports from UN agencies and Palestinian prisoner advocacy groups document a disturbing pattern of torture, sexual violence, starvation, medical neglect and arbitrary detention without trial. With thousands imprisoned, including women and children, many held under administrative detention, the incarceration system has become an extension of broader policies of domination and dehumanization. I am Bahman Noura, your host, and this spotlight seeks to see whether these practices constitute not isolated abuses, but a deliberate institutionalized machinery of oppression that violates international law and the most fundamental principles of human dignity. Let us begin with the report.
Since the outbreak of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, Palestinian men and women held in Israeli military and prison facilities have faced systematic ill-treatment, including torture, sexual violence, and severe neglect. Many have died after being abducted and held under inhuman conditions. According to a 2024 report by the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, many inmates from Gaza and the West Bank have been held arbitrarily, blindfolded, shackled, and often without being informed of the reasons for their detention or granted access to legal counsel. Also, testimonies from released prisoners describe repeated beatings, stress positions, electric shocks, the use of dogs during interrogations, and forced nudity or other forms of degrading treatment. Many detainees return to their families or to medical examiners with signs of severe beatings, starvation, and untreated medical conditions.
They use tear gas against us every week. It's difficult to describe the pain we suffered in the prison. The men were constantly being beaten.
We weren't allowed to sleep. They forced us to stay awake for 16 hours. The food is terrible. You need permission to go to the toilet. They forbid us from praying.
Local NGOs say nearly 100 Palestinians have died in Israeli prisons or detention centers since 2 years ago. The real number is believed to be far higher due to a lack of transparency, missing detainees, and Israeli regime's refusal to release full information. UN experts have repeatedly raised the alarm over arbitrary detentions and widespread mistreatment of prisoners. They have demanded Israel immediately end the systematic torture and abuse of Palestinian detainees to protect their rights to life and to allow independent oversight.
There continue to be the use of practices that clearly violate the prohibition on torture and other cruel, inhuman or degrading treatments, such as constant blindfolding, stress positions, handcuffing for extended periods of time, overcrowding, degrading conditions.
Israeli officials have denied access to independent monitors and have failed to comply with court orders demanding improved food, hygiene, and medical care inside detention facilities. Global human rights organizations warn without an independent international investigation and full detainee information, prisoners and their families will continue to be denied justice and more detainees will remain at risk.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Mohammed Al-Ghiq, political analyst, writer, and former Palestinian prisoner, joining us from Ramallah. And Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief from MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. Well, it is indeed a pleasure to have my guest with me. It is a very important topic, and I'm going to start. Let me see which one of my guests is available right now. Mohammed Al-Ghiq is with me right now. Mohammed, I'm going to start the conversation with you. First, I want to talk about the legal and more specifically the international law perspective. These administrative detentions, how do they align with or contradict international legal standards?
Yeah, thank you for having me. First and foremost, Israel ignored the international community, ignored the international law. And by the way, it uses the administrative detention as a tool to torture the Palestinians, to prevent them from their life, to distract their daily life, their future, under the pretext of secret informations or files to prevent them from resistance, etc. I think the recent actions from the Israeli prison service and the Israeli army, the Israeli government, indicate the systematic, the organized policies against the Palestinians, prisoners, their life. The Palestinian prisoners, by the way, have been subjected to torture, isolation, medical negligence. All of these types of restrictions or collective punishment, as you like to name, all these policies, I think, Israel took it because took them because the absence of the accountability, the absence of the real will of the international community, the international law, and the silence of the Arab countries, the Muslim countries, that encouraged Israel to take bolder steps against the Palestinian prisoners by starving them, isolating them,
right,
torturing them. This is the point here, and with this, with these conditions, I think Israel will take more steps against them.
Mohammed, now that they are, you're assuming that these are like contrary to the international law, what I want you to tell me, can these actions be also classified as war crimes or crimes against humanity?
This is an important question. Thank you for this question. We are here, let's look at a bigger picture now. We saw the measures of ICJ and ICC against Netanyahu, Yoav Gallant, and some officials in Israel, but we didn't see any action from ICJ, at least, against the head of the Israeli prison service. She has to be held accountable here, and we didn't see any actions. That means the pressure from U.S. on the ICJ and ICC, even the United Nations, is huge to prevent them from take any points or any steps against Israel. Now, with this situation, okay, Israel will go ahead against the Palestinians. By the way, they are preparing for execution bill against the Palestinian prisoners to achieve many goals here. And why they wanted that?
Right.
Because the paralyzed will of the international community.
Indeed, very insightful. Thank you so much, Mohammed. Well, gladly, Leila Hatoum is also with us right now. Leila is editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored. Great to have you on this program. Leila, we're talking about the legal perspective on the issue of abuses that are happening and occurring and reoccurring in Israeli jails. Now that we can consider them, if we can consider them like crimes against humanity and war crimes, what will be the role of the International Criminal Court now?
Most definitely not only crimes against humanity, but war crimes as well. You have to understand, under international law, Israel is considered an occupation power. That's why the United Nations calls the West Bank the occupied Palestinian territories. In that sense, the occupation has duties and obligations. One of them is not to persecute or ethnically cleanse the land or basically do arbitrary detention and torturing people. So at the end of the day, because of the state of war between the Palestinians and the Israeli occupation, because of the state of the occupation under international law, this is considered not only a crime against humanity, but also a war crime. Needless to say that every war crime is a crime against humanity in that sense. Detaining people without basically arbitrary detention, without any basically cause, at the same time torture, sexual assault, raping, among other things, electrocution, constant blindfolding, all of those constitute crimes. However, you have to bring them to the court of justice, be it the ICJ through countries, like basically South Africa did to the genocide that's happening in Gaza, or basically to the ICC against certain individuals to be able to prosecute the Israelis over that matter. Unfortunately, until today, we did not see neither the, like we saw neither the Palestinian Authority nor the states actually bringing these cases to the ICJ. They only brought the cases that were happening in Gaza, the constant genocide over there, to actually go after the Israeli occupation and its officers and its basically officials as well. So in the next phase, we need to see states and what you call larger entities, like Human Rights Watch, among others, moving such cases at the ICC level. So no matter what, we need to have cases to be able to prosecute the Israelis. However, I do understand that the ICC and the ICJ are paper tigers. They're toothless. They have no ability to implement their decisions. So in that sense, you have to have the victims or their families file individual lawsuits or class action lawsuits
right.
against Israeli officials who are directly tied to such crimes like Ben-Gvir, among others, in different countries across the world.
Right, Mohammed, well, of course, you're a former prisoner. You've experienced and been through the Israeli prison life. I want you to tell me, to what extent do you believe policies like this administrative detention are rooted in security concerns rather than political directives?
Yes, as your guest, Laila, said, the international community, the international law, put Israel and encouraged Israel to go through these policies, like the administrative detention. Okay, when they arrested me, for example, when they arrested me, they accused me with many charges, like military actions, etc. I refused these charges. They threatened me to go through the administrative detention or to admit these charges. I refused, and they changed me, and they turned me to administrative detention. I began my hunger strike against that. Why they use this policy, the administrative detention, to achieve many goals, to prevent the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, and to vanish or to destroy the spiritual soul of the Palestinians, especially the prisoners inside jails, to intimidate the Palestinian people, the internal front, and to deter the leaders of the resistance in the West Bank, or influencers, writers, academic staffs, students, all these sectors, Israel considered them as a terrorism or as a threat against its existence. This is the policy of Israel against the Palestinians in the West Bank under many pretexts. Now they use the same policy against the Palestinians from Gaza, from West Bank, Jerusalem. Why? To achieve these goals, to deter the Palestinians. I think with the silence of the international community, Israel considers itself above the international law. And by the way, it took bolder steps against the Palestinians to torture them, to isolate them. By the way, we saw the two recent stories in one day, the story of Tasnim Al-Hams from Gaza and her conditions reflect the situation inside the Israeli jail, the reality there, and the second story from Jenin. After they arrested two people there, they shoot them, they killed them. Why? This is the law of as jungle land. They use these policies against the Palestinians because the absence of the accountability.
Right. Leila, I wanted to talk to you about the effect of this aggressive and inhumane, one must say, prisoner policies in Israel and how it affects the broader Israeli-Palestine conflict.
Well, you have to understand that the Israelis are not there to actually create peace between them and the Palestinians or any of their neighbors. In that sense, they have to create an atmosphere of animosity around them. And how do they do that? By targeting every generation. It's very rare to find a single Palestinian, be it a child, a teenager, or a man, who hasn't served, even a woman, by the way, who haven't served some time in the Israeli concentration camps. These are not prisons. Again, this is an occupation. So these are concentration camps. Most of them have basically suffered under arbitrary detention and administrative detention, as we call it, which is detaining people without cause for lengthy periods of time. So at the end of the day, they are creating that atmosphere of animosity around them to create that friction and to tell the world, look at us. We are trying to find peace over here, but the people around us hate peace and they keep attacking us, so we have to eliminate them. The way that it reflects on the Palestinian society and the relations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, there will always be vendetta. I mean, if they haven't killed somebody from a Palestinian family, they have surely detained one and tortured one, and they have taken loved ones away from their families. In that sense, they will continue to disrupt the fabric within the Palestinian society, and they will continue to create that friction. And eventually, basically, we saw what happened. Tension in Gaza, tension in the West Bank. Today, they have basically cleaned the Palestinian refugee camps of nearly 56,000 Palestinians. They are not allowed to go back to their basically camps in the West Bank, right? And they have detained most of them, including one of the mayors from Tammun. So when you look at the whole situation, the Israelis are looking to create that friction so they can use it as an excuse to continue to take further land and attack the Palestinians. The Palestinians will feel left out by the international community, as usual, and they will have to take matters into their own hands, and then they will be blamed for it, and they will be called terrorists. It will be always that broken record of the Israelis creating a problem, the Palestinians retaliating to it, then the Palestinians will be blamed for the fact that they are actually retaliating.
Right, Mohammed, if you remember a few weeks ago when the video of the Israeli abuse in prison was leaked by a high-ranked military official of Israel, we were discussing this and you said this is not just to inform others, this is to instill fears and this is a propaganda step by the Israeli regime. It's well thought of. I want to talk about the Israeli domestic politics. How do you think they affect such prisoner policies?
I think Israel implements the carrot and the stick policy against the Palestinians, and measures, desperate times, desperate measures. They don't care about the humanity. They don't care about human laws or humanitarian coordination or something else, or even the humanitarian protocol. They violated the international law. They violated all the international laws, most notably the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. But I will be precise here. The Israeli government intensified these policies against the Palestinians to achieve the main goal for them, the nucleus goal, to expand it, its territories, and to put more pressure on the Palestinians, especially in the West Bank. When you see the daily life in the West Bank, you will be surprised. Checkpoints, military barriers, iron gates, demolishing homes, confiscating land, and they intensified the settlers' attacks against the Palestinian properties, main roads, water springs, pastoral areas, etc. Why Israel implemented these policies? To annex the West Bank, to cram people into the hard cities, and to deter the Palestinians, to prevent the resistance, and to send a message to the neighboring countries that Israel has a plan, and it coordinated its plan with Trump to go through the new Middle East project, to go through Greater Israel at the expense of the Palestinians, at the expense of the neighboring countries, at the expense of the stability and prosperity in the region. This is the point for Israel, because of that they use these policies against prisoners, against people, against civilians in the West Bank and Gaza, even in Jerusalem.
Right, Leila, I want to not talk about the international reactions to these allegations. Ethically speaking, what is the responsibility of the global communities and also the NGOs, both in recording these abuses and responding to them?
Well, you have to understand that most of the international community, including the big five countries at one point in time, have signed or ratified or joined almost all of the agreements when it comes to human rights, when it comes to stopping a genocide, when it comes to upholding their role in the international community to stop crimes against humanity. So at the end of the day, when you look at the situation where some of the countries show that they are shocked, but they don't do any action, others disregard it completely, playing dumb, basically deaf and blind, it tells you a lot that almost all of the international community is complicit on this in this matter. Otherwise, the Israelis wouldn't have been flying above the radar and above international law. They have impunity because of this lack of action, the inaction of the international community. We have 192 member states of the United Nations and one entity, which is the occupation entity. And the 192, you only have about 191 who actually didn't take any action, and only one took an action. That's basically Iran. We have to be very, very clear about this. The only state that took action as a state is Iran. The rest of the states, they didn't do anything. Sending a few packages of food over here and there, throwing some money to on the problem, it doesn't change anything. Boycott should have been played on a wider scale. It didn't. And that's the least that they could have done. They kept the Israeli entity as a member, quasi-member of the United Nations. The United Nations didn't kick them out or suspend them. And that's very interesting to see. And then you have the big five countries protecting the Israeli entity. So at the end of the day, I'm looking at complicity, hypocrisy, and the will not to do any action. This is by will. This is actually something that they chose to do.
Regarding this willingness, Mohammed, I want to see, what do you think about the Israeli response to all the UN resolutions, some international calls that exist in order to end these alleged abuses of the Palestinian detainees? What does it say about Israel's willingness to engage with global accountability mechanisms?
Unfortunately, let me clarify something for you. The recent decision from the Security Council about Gaza vanished all the resolutions, all the decisions to give the Palestinians their rights. And by the way, the recent decision gave Israel more self-confidence, gave Israel more a huge permission to go through the annexation plan, to go through its policies against the Palestinians. And when we are talking about the international community, the complicity, the silence of the Arab regimes, we are talking about the massacres of Israel and bolder steps on the ground. Now, what is the point of United Nations Charter if it doesn't stop the starvation, the genocide, the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, the organized policies against the Palestinian prisoners, at least to give the Palestinians their right? We heard many stories from the Israeli jails, not to mention Sidi Timan, rape crimes, or et cetera, something about the Palestinian prisoners. We are talking about the reality now. Israel wanted to change the reality in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Jerusalem, and the neighboring countries to implement its plan. And we have to see the actions from the international community. Now, we have nothing. All these efforts will be in vain because there is no accountability now.
Right.
Let me tell you about the prisoners. We didn't hear or we didn't see any statement from the international community of the Red Cross about the Palestinian prisoners and the subjugation and the policies against them. But we are hearing many statements. We are seeing many stances from the international community, from the international institutions about the Israeli prisoners, and they asked, they demanded to bring them back home. But about the Palestinian prisoners, nothing. This is the double standards policy.
Right. It was a pleasure to have you both on this show. Thank you so much, Mohammed Al-Ghig, political analyst, writer, and former Palestinian prisoner joining us from Ramallah, and also Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. So this was another Spotlight. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. 19-year-old Zahra Abdul Karim Mohanna had a single priority during the two-year genocide raging on them in Gaza, that is to protect her brothers and save their lives at any cost. Having lost her father, she preferred pangs of hunger than risk her brothers going to seek aid where scores of young men were targeted, disappeared, and shot. They have resisted the occupation and always will, Zahra says, but asks why they need to do that when the rest of the world is free. Here is more of Zahra.
Despite the history, occupation, and Gaza's classification as the world's largest open-air prison, by many who experienced its suffocating conditions, there was a semblance of a life. For young Palestinians like the one who shared her story with us, there was a rhythm to life with the Israeli occupation, simply the soundtrack. Building a future despite Gaza's situation was something that kept the next generation hopeful, studying, preparing, and working towards a day when there would be a different world. Israel's barbarity has replaced that with something utterly different. Life under genocide was a literal hellscape. The struggle to find something to eat outweighed by the psychological torture, in Zahra's case, of wondering if the occupation would martyr or take her brothers at any given moment. Activities once considered routine now took on an additional layer of jeopardy. Some of the sights witnessed are enough to change your very DNA, such as the tragedy playing out in real time. It's not just the obvious lack of regard for Palestinian lives, it's also the way in which Israel's genocide has changed even the landscape of Gaza. Orphans have been created, children forever scarred in an environment that is now completely alien, with all familiarity wiped from the face of the earth. Coming to terms with the new reality of Gaza has altered some things. There is no way the people, the ones who survived in any case, would not emerge unscathed, though the one thing that has remained is the Palestinian steadfastness. It was terrifying how quickly Zahra's life, like the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, became centered on the search to satiate hungry bellies. With such scarcity, finding sustenance would consume Gazan lives. Every day, Zahra checks in on the condition of her immediate family, a literal headcount, and then begins the soul-sapping business of making it through another day. The genocide has left those who have survived it physically absolutely spent. The new truce, or the so-called ceasefire, cannot be another false dawn. Something more just and lasting is needed. Palestinians are beyond tired.
Joining me today to discuss Zahra's story is Fatima Dosa, who is a pharmacist and a political activist. Welcome, Fatima.
Thank you for inviting me. It's okay.
Yeah. Fatima, you've spent decades, you know, advocating for the rights of Palestinians. I know you've been doing so many different kind of things, you know, over the years. We have watched Palestinian women, you know, generation after generation, suffering what Zahra is talking about. She's 19 years old, but this is not something that, you know, she's born into it. Her mother was born into it. Her grandmother's gone through it. Fatima, will this ever end?
It's a very important question, Sakina. You know, you're right in saying that throughout our lifetime, you know, in my 40th decade, and that's all we've seen. It's the same conversations and it's the same stories. And the endurance of Palestinian women and what they've suffered is because of the dispossession, the displacement, the occupation, the apartheid. And it can only end when justice is done, when they're no longer living in fear. You know, they're fighting for their, what we're seeing in this genocide is they're fighting for their very existence. But I have every hope that this will end when Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. You know, as we are seeing, as the decades have gone by, their story has come more and more in the front. And we are seeing that the world has now woken up to the reality of what Palestine is, the dispossession, the occupation, and that Israel is now very much a pariah state. You know, the narrative has changed totally. And I have every hope that what we see in the liberation of Palestine, that it will not only be a dream that is whispered in the night, but it will be a lived reality for the Palestinians and for the women and the children that have gone through so much decade after decade.
Do you think it is this genocide that has created this momentum? I've said before, we've done processions for many, many, many years. But it would be, you know, when something happens, people go onto the street and then everybody forgets about it. You know, when we talk of the BDS, we boycott things for a while and then we go back into it. But do you think that has changed? Do you think the momentum in watching a live stream genocide has changed things?
You know, you're right. Again, this is the first time that we are seeing a live stream genocide and that the social media has captured this. You know, sometimes we blame social media for a lot of bad things, but actually it is social media that has opened a lot of people's eyes to the reality, because what they have seen cannot be unseen. You know, one thing that really, a phrase that caught me once when I was listening to Butch Weir, who was had stood up for the vice president of the Green Party in America, was that we have to move from being a moment, what happened with George Floyd was a moment, but to make it into a movement. And now what we see is a movement. You know, the outrage that we have seen is organized, that even when the ceasefire was called, the march that happened was the biggest after the ceasefire was called. People could see through that ceasefire and the superficiality of that ceasefire, and that people out on the streets throughout the globe, in every strata of society, are committed to having that free Palestine and to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians, and to make sure that their future now is not decided by the imperialists and the colonizers, but by the Palestinians themselves, including the people who have sought to have armed resistance. Because, unfortunately, this is the only way that we will see the liberation of Palestine.
Absolutely, Fatima. And I wanted to bring in the issue of the Gen Z here, you know, because we watch Zahra. Zahra is only 19 years old, but she speaks with, you know, she's grown up more than a year in these 2 years, the wisdom with which she's talking, you know, of how She first talks about all the difficulties she has faced, you know, the fear of losing her brothers. And then she says, we're not going anywhere. We're not going to make it easy for them. You know, our parents, our grandmothers have resisted, and today's women will resist. How is this playing out for the rest of the world, the Gen Z? We see huge movement among them. Are they seeking direct, you know, inspiration from women like Zahra?
Absolutely. I think from the whole of Palestinians, that we can see how the women have stood up, how the children have stood up. But even the men, sometimes even the men get forgotten in these. And I think what Gen Z is seeing is in their Palestinians is a clear moral clarity. They're seeing resistance, they're seeing resilience, and they're seeing the courage to stand up to the powers that be. And it's in their steadfastness, they're seeing not only the resilience and the resistance, but that even in the worst of times and in the darkest of times, that there is hope and that you can stand up with compassion, with conviction. And that is very apparent that the Palestinians are not desperate.
Of course, along with the fact that, not only are they brave, but their faith in God. You know, it's just astounding, because when they're going through the most difficult of times, you will hear Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel, which is such a strong faith. But finally, Fatima, we don't have much time left, but, you run decolonization sessions. I want to quickly pick on that, because we've had, some of our viewers saying that you should not be using the word colonization today, because for the white people who may not be colonized, who may already be on the side of resistance and pro-Palestinian, they feel like this is attacking white people around the world. What's your view on that?
It's an interesting question. It's a perspective I have to admit that I haven't really given much thought. But when I look at the reality out there, over the last 500 years, we are seeing imperialism and we are seeing colonization. The colonization of lands may have gone, like I've grown up in Africa, but the colonization of our resources has not gone. The colonization of our minds have not gone. So it is a lived reality for many people that I feel the white people who may not be colonized and who can see through this have to understand that for majority of the world, colonization is what they are living with. And the face of that colonization is white supremacy and whiteness. So it's not something that we can just escape from. We can't just say slavery didn't happen. We can't say apartheid didn't happen. It is a reality that for the people who are experiencing, it is very much a reality, and we have to understand that it is not something that we can just say.
Absolutely. And at least if there was no more colonization, then that's another issue.
Yeah.
But we're very much living, presently with all sorts of colonized, aspects in our lives. And finally, Fatima, talking about home here, and our responsibilities, the Tories were horrible, but the Keir Starmer's Labour has proven to be even worse. Our country has been complicit, continues to be complicit in this genocide. What do we do? What is our role?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. One thing that has the genocide, what we've witnessed, is a huge horror, but it's also very transformative, because what we've seen through that all the illusions of democracy, of rule of law, has fallen away. All the veils have gone. The masks are off and the gloves are on. And it's important for us that this outrage is organized into a movement, and to make sure that the system, because we come back to the fact that this is, whether it's Tories, whether it's the Labour Party, or whether it's the Liberal Democrats, it's the system that is an issue. But at the moment, we have to work in a two-pronged way. We have to work within the system to use their laws to make sure that we hold them to account, political account. So we make sure we don't vote for them, and that we have our own independent MPs. Legal accountability, that we are using international law to bring them into court, which is what a lot of organizations like Al-Haq are doing, to say that, for example, you cannot sell arms to a country that is committing genocide. So we should hold them to account. We should hold the leaders into account. And also the institutions that are like the media institutions, the NGOs.
Thank you all. We leave you with the sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Goodbye.
The earth and the heavens begin to sing. The angels celebrate the birth of a king. A king who outshines the stars of the night. A beacon of hope. You guide us with your blessings of God upon you is my prayer. The earth and the heavens begin to sing. This day we celebrate the birth of a king.
Greetings, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's a preview of what's coming up next on your trusted radio station. Up first, take a moment for thoughtful reflection with Hadith of the Day. Next, we turn to Islamic laws with Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of the prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Following that, join us for Africa Today. For those seeking to deepen their connection with the Holy Quran, don't miss Let's Recite the Quran. Coming up next, it's the Hadith of the Day. Stay tuned.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. So, we begin with a profound saying of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his holy progeny. A nation will never be sanctified if the rights of the weak are not taken from the strong without hesitation. So, if you cannot talk in front of the stronger positions, like those who are stronger in this, in their status in the society, to gain or to actually attain your rights. So that's not a good society you're living in. This hadith is not just about personal morality, but about the very foundation of justice in society. Think of a community where the poor, the orphan, or the marginalized cannot claim their rights because they fear the powerful. That society may appear developed, but spiritually it is weak. The Prophet reminds us that real greatness is not measured by wealth or armies or skyscrapers. It's measured by whether justice is accessible to everyone, anyone and everyone, especially the weakest. History shows us this truth. The downfall of many empires was not poverty or lack of knowledge, but corruption, injustice, and ignoring the oppressed. When power protects privilege instead of truth, nations rot from within. Modern social science confirms this. Studies show that societies with stronger justice systems and equality, or equity actually, have higher levels of trust, cooperation, and even economic growth. The World Happiness Report consistently ranks countries where the rule of law protects both rich and poor equally at the top of well-being indexes. On the other hand, inequality and unchecked power creates stress, violence, and division, and many other problems. Psychologists know that perceived injustice is one of the strongest triggers for anger and social unrest. And you could imagine what that leads to. So how can we live this teaching today? Defend fairness at home. Treat children equally. Don't let the stronger sibling dominate the weaker, or vice versa, maybe. Be the voice for the voiceless. Speak up when you see unfair treatment, whether at work, school, or community. And support just systems, whether through voting, volunteering, or community work. Help build structures where everyone's rights are secure, and practice courage. The hadith says rights must be taken without hesitation. That means we must train ourselves not to be silent in front of oppression. Be robust against any injustice. Thank you for joining. May we all become voices of justice and protectors of the weak. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala
Bangladesh Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We have been discussing some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature, and I'd like to ask you, Sheikh Javid, a question regarding that. Of course, you kindly provide us the answers to these questions of jurisprudence based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. My question, or first question, is regarding tajafi, a kind of half-sitting that some people, people who are offering their prayers, the Muslims who are saying their prayers, do. What is the law, the Islamic law, regarding this kind of sitting?
Well, tajafi means, as you rightly mentioned, it is a half kind of sitting. When, for example, the imam is in the second rak'ah and you are in the first rak'ah, you cannot sit in the same way as the imam or other people who are performing their second rak'ah. So yes, you just sit in between, standing and sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is recommended that you sit in that posture.
Right.
Okay. And it's not wajib. If you happen to sit down, still your prayers is in order. It's valid. And you can keep doing the jama'at prayer
mm-hmm.
with the imam.
But if you sit in the same way as the imam,
yes,
or the rest of the actually...
Your prayer is not made void.
Uh-huh.
Your prayer is not, it is still valid. And you can keep praying with the imam, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But tajafi is recommended. It's not wajib.
Right, I see. A lady asked us, what is the Islamic law regarding the illicit gains of our husband? We know that, for example, our husband's salary or gains...